Someone set me up. Someone from the inside.
Now, this only ends one way. A bullet.
Welcome to Now Playing's bonus review of Atomic Blonde.
The clock is ticking, and everyone you get close to ends up dead.
Hosted by Arnie.
I'm not gonna lie, I'm impressed.
You should see my balls, and you'd be really impressed.
Justin.
I look for pleasure in the details.
And Jacob.
An expert in intelligence collection and hand-to-hand combat.
This podcast will contain detailed plot spoilers and harsh language.
Oh, bollocks.
Listener discretion is advised.
Fasten your seatbelt.
Today we're discussing Atomic Blonde, starring Charlize Theron, James McAvoy, John Goodman, and Toby Jones, directed by David Leitch. This is the Now Playing co-host who thinks three isn't always a crowd, but maybe tonight it is. We'll find out. This is Arnie.
And this is Double Agent Justin.
And this is Jacob, the host with the disastrous Sinead O'Connor haircut. Guys, you want to feel it?
Kind of. You know, I used to have a haircut like that, too. It is fun to run your hands through and feel the bristles.
Yeah, that was my haircut for most of high school.
So welcome back, Justin, to the show, and welcome back, patrons, to this bonus review of Now Playing. I have to say, I'm really happy this year, because there were two movies that, when we were covering movies really early in the year and late last year, kept seeing trailers for, and I'm like, damn, those movies look good. I didn't just want to see them, but I wanted to cover them for the show. We've now gotten to do both. The first was Baby Driver, we covered over on the main feed. The second was Atomic Blonde, and I didn't see a way to review it, and Jacob, you're like, hey, let's get Justin back, because this is David Leitch, director of the first John Wick, co-director of it, also director of the upcoming Deadpool 2. Make it a patron show. I'm like, damn, I'm in, because these trailers looked good.
Yeah, I didn't even know that it had that John Wick connection. I mean, these gender switch films are just coming so fast these days. Ghostbusters and Doctor Who and now John Wick. They've already got the gender switch film. I mean, it did look from that trailer like a John Wick type film, action film.
That's what the trailer sold us, right? It was kind of a mindless shoot 'em up with a lot of style. And that's really all I knew going into this thing.
I did too. I knew just enough to find out that it was based on a comic book, which Jacob's the comic book guy, so I'm like, Jacob, hey, there's a graphic novel for you to read before we go see this. But other than just knowing it was based on an Oni Press book, I went in just off a couple trailers looking for a kick-ass good time.
Yeah, look, I did read that graphic novel, The Coldest City. It has now been rebranded, Atomic Blonde, The Coldest City, so to get people to buy it that have seen this movie and like it. Here's the thing. It's a really dry spy novel, and that's just not my thing. Like, I read a Tom Clancy novel, and it's got all those government acronyms and all the cloak and dagger stuff, and for people that really like that, they'll probably like this graphic novel. It's not my kind of story, and it's, again, very dry. I read this book, and I'm like, well, obviously, for whatever reasons, they bought the rights to this book, but they're not going to use anything from it. First of all, the female character is not blonde. She's a brunette, and she's kind of dowdy looking. And that might just be I just don't like the art. It's pretty low-key art. So if she's supposed to look like Charlize Theron, that did not come across on the page. But it was a lot of, like, sitting around and talking about the Cold War and talking about Berlin and what that means. And there's a staircase scene. It's not like the staircase seen in this movie, though. It lasts about a page. So I'm like, wow, they're throwing all this out. The shock to me, though, is how much of this graphic novel is in the movie. Lots of it. You know, if that's not your thing, that kind of graphic novel, I pre-warned here, that kind of dry spy cloak and dagger stuff made it into this film, which again surprised me because I found it very boring.
It's strange because I hadn't heard of this graphic novel going in, but after seeing the movie, it felt very much like a graphic novel come to life. So I wanted to check out the style of this book. And I was very surprised to see that it's very black and white. And like you said, Jacob, drab. It has none of the style that made it into the movie, at least visually.
Yeah, no neon. To me, it's very rough art and very hard to discern at times what's going on. especially when it's all about just all these characters and you got to have that facial recognition. And it's just hard to remember all the characters that are introduced and all their different dealings, the French and the British and the Russians and all the spy work going on.
Yeah, we'll be getting into that when we talk about the movie itself. It was definitely, I think, a little bit confusing on the screen. Maybe having read a book ahead of time would help with some of that.
Yeah, thankfully, as much as I dislike that graphic novel, I'm glad I read it because, man, I think I would have been really lost in this movie if I hadn't. Like, at least I was able to go, okay, that's what this was talking about in the book. Okay, I can make this connection.
And we're not dealing with like a Watchmen type of situation here where this is an older graphic novel that just couldn't be brought to film for all these years. This is a newer graphic novel, am I right?
It's from 2012, and what I read was, I guess Charlize Theron has a production company that bought the rights to this, and they've been working on it for 5 years, so like, they got the rights to this right away, if that timeline is right.
Yeah, I'd read that she was working on it for 5 years, but really, it seems like it kicked into gear about 2.5 years ago. I mean, when I saw Charlize Theron in these trailers, I'll admit, Mad Max Fury Road did a great favor for her. I completely forgot she was in Aeon Flux.
I still love her as Mr. F in Arrested Development.
I kept thinking that this whole movie. Mr. F. I
forgot about that too. But she tried to be the kick-ass kind of comic book woman in Aeon Flux. That movie, oof.
Was that the Ghost in the Shell of its day?
It kind of was.
Yeah, the cartoon was decent. The movie, not so much.
No, and it had a good visual style is all I can say. But when Fury Road came out, Charlize Theron was such a badass in that movie. I mean, she just completely held her own. Some say stole the movie from Tom Hardy. Well, it was the success of that film that got everything moving. That month that Fury Road came out, the announcement was made this movie was coming out. Focus Features immediately acquired distribution rights to the film, knowing that it wouldn't be out until 2017. Everything got going. And yeah, David Leitch was working on John Wick Chapter 2, got a chance to direct this solo. It was filmed in 2015 and 2016. It's been done for a while. It was originally premiered at South by Southwest in March of this year and is now getting theatrical release. A summer movie, though. They had a lot of faith in this, I think based a lot on Charlize's name.
I mean, that trailer was great, too. That trailer won awards, which is basically just a fight scene. But whatever this film ends up being, that trailer sold me on it. Yeah, that it looked like a big, fun, fast-paced summer action movie.
You're right. Fast-paced is the right word. But that trailer went by so fast that I really retained nothing from it until we'll get to it later. But one of the final scenes of the movie ends up being in that trailer. And I was like, oh yeah, I have seen this part before.
The other thing that got me is the song from that trailer. It was a new wave song, Blue Monday. It was a cover by a band called Health. And it's just, that's a song I like a lot from New Order. And when you merged that with the kick-ass action, and I'll admit, I had a connection going on. Co-starring in this film is James McAvoy.
You're a big fan of his.
I am. I've talked about him in the X-Men films, and one of the first films I ever really saw him in, before I saw X-Men First Class, was this movie called Starter for 10, which came out in 2006.
Yeah, an 80s period piece, right?
Yeah, taking place in the UK with a lot of new wave music. It's such a good movie. It's actually in our underrated movies book. Marjorie and I kind of fought over who gets to put it in because it is certainly at least an underseen movie. So you got James McAvoy with new wave music plus Charlize Theron kicking ass. That's what got me all excited. I think I was thinking about how good Starter for 10 was, loving McAvoy, loving Theron from Mad Max, and just wanting to see where this went.
It's funny because I was just sold on that trailer. I saw James McAvoy's name like on the posters. I don't ever remember seeing him in a trailer. Like it was a surprise the first time I saw the poster and saw his name. I'm like, oh, he's in this too? Because I don't think they've ever featured him.
You know what? I couldn't have told you anybody outside of Charlize was in this. I was surprised to find out John Goodman was in it. You know, I think I knew going in McAvoy was there, but this movie has a cast of characters that I think have enough weight and chops to make a movie interesting.
What surprised me is when the movie starts or when I actually saw the poster that McAvoy is basically a double billed lead. You watch the trailers, you see the marketing, and it's Theron, 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 but McAvoy is a star in his own rights, as much as we have them anymore these days, and so he is got his name right next to hers on that poster and right after hers in the credits.
Yeah, but I do think the selling point is Charlize Theron bringing it over from Mad Max. Wonder Woman's the biggest movie this summer. We want kick-ass woman. I enjoy watching a kick-ass woman as much as Van Damme or Sylvester Stallone in an 80s action flick. That's fun to see, and that's one of the things we call that with John Wick is that he'll punch the girls just as hard as the guys, and so that's what I was really looking for, is just a tough female noir action film.
And you know what? Starting with the credits and rolling right into the first few minutes of this movie, we get that kick-ass female action that is kind of counter-programming to the somewhat wholesomeness of Wonder Woman earlier this year.
I can definitely see two sides of a similar coin here, and I know people are kind of drawing their line in the sand. Those who have seen Atomic Blonde are definitely going, which one was more badass female, Wonder Woman or Lorraine? I'll just start off by saying Lorraine is a terrible spy name. I have bad associations with the name Lorraine. Lorraine Broughton is no James Bond. It doesn't just roll off the tongue. I'm like, really? Her name's Lorraine?
It's funny because my wife and I, when we're discussing the movie afterwards, we called everyone else by their name except for Charlize Theron. We just called her Charlize. We didn't even remember her name.
That's impressive. The only name I walked out of there remembering was Percival. That's the only one that stuck.
But yeah, I don't know. I don't think there's a reason you need to have these two fight each other, Wonder Woman and Lorraine from Atomic Blonde. Put them in a movie together. Once Wonder Woman films catch up to the Cold War, I guess they got to do World War II and then Korean War, Vietnam. But yeah, put them together. I don't think there's any reason that you have to have a cat fight, though many may want to see that between Gal Gadot and Charlize.
Or maybe a lesbian subplot. This movie has that too.
Well, let's get to that lesbian subplot. Arnie, you got a plot summary for us?
Well, Atomic Blonde is a period piece. I didn't get that from the trailers.
Oh, you don't like those. It's a war movie and a period piece. Flashbacks to Dunkirk.
Depends on the period.
Yeah, I guess it's when you were alive, so you're okay with the period.
That does actually help. It's November 1989, and Charlize Theron plays MI6 spy Lorraine Broughton. She's being sent to Berlin to follow up on the murder of her fellow spy and former lover, James Gascoigne, played briefly by Sam Hargrave. Gascoigne had come into possession of a microfilm called simply The List, detailing every undercover operative and shady deal of the past 40 years.
Can we call it The Knock List? This is Mission Impossible again.
Yeah, what was the other film that had a knock list very recently?
It was the Wonder Woman, the Kathy Lee Crosby Wonder Woman film.
Right, yes.
the TV one.
Yes.
I knew we had another knock list really recently. I'm like, everybody's given a knock list. But Gascoigne was ambushed and killed by KGB agent Yuri Bakhtin. But Yuri doesn't take the list to his superiors, instead trying to sell it. More, the list reveals the name of a traitorous MI6 operative codenamed Satchel. Satchel has leaked info out of MI6 for years. Lorraine is to recover the list and capture or kill Satchel. Her contact in Berlin is David Percival, played by James McAvoy. Percival has been undercover in Berlin for a decade and made a niche for himself selling Western contraband to East Berliners. As Lorraine is told to trust no one, she doesn't trust Percival, especially when she's ambushed immediately upon landing in West Berlin. She exploits her contacts and makes new ones, including French spy Delphine LaSalle, played by Sophia Boutella, and the two begin an affair. But Percival is keeping secrets. He was friends with Gascoigne, and knows Gascoigne got the list from Stasi officer codenamed Spyglass, played by Eddie Marson. More, Spyglass has memorized the list and offers it to Percival in exchange for he and his family being smuggled across the border. Percival agrees and gets Lorraine to aid in the transport. But before the mission, Percival tracks down Yuri and steals the watch with the list in it. Prepared to sell it himself, Percival shoots Spyglass during the extraction, leaving Lorraine on her own to fight off dozens of KGB agents. Beaten and bruised, Lorraine makes it back to East Berlin, but in going to Dolphine's apartment, she sees photographic evidence of Percival colluding with the KGB. For this, Percival killed Dolphine. Lorraine tracks down and kills Percival and returns to England with audio evidence that she spliced together, proving Percival was Satchel, but she says the list was lost. But in truth, she was Satchel. We see her meeting with Russian KGB boss Alexander Bremovich. She gives him the list, but he goes to kill her. She kills Bremovich and his agents and reveals the list she gave him is a fake. Because we find out, in truth, she's a CIA agent who is posing as an MI6 double agent. As she gives the list to her boss, CIA agent Emmett Kurtzfeld, played by John Goodman, and the two fly back to the USA as credits roll. So she's a triple agent with double crosses. Is that a quadruple cross?
Yeah, and that is something that's added for this movie. In the book, she's just a double agent, and that's the big reveal, is that she is working for the Russians the whole time. Here, they took it one further. They got me, because I'm like, well, I know her secret because I read the book. But yeah, lots of twists and turns in this. I guess we got to start trying to figure it all out.
Well, I wonder how much of current events maybe shaped a new ending.
Where... Yeah, do we really want the Russians controlling everything by the end of this film? Is that a little too close to home?
Oh, that is a good point. I hadn't put that together, but I was surprised when this movie started that we are in 1989. It puts it there. We get some Ronald Reagan quotes, Mr. Gorbachev, tear down this wall, you know, the very famous one. And that New Order song, New Order's version of it, is playing. And we get the headline, 1989, after 28 years, the Berlin Wall came down and the Cold War ended. This is not that story.
Yeah, which is weird because the graphic novel, Justin, you brought up Watchmen. And what's interesting about that graphic novel is that it does have a similar theme, that what happens with this old order of East versus West, the Russians versus the Americans, when that wall comes down. And it's really all about that idea, you know, is the world going to be a safer, more peaceful place, or is that danger going to go on and we'll never have world peace? I do feel like this movie, they'll give some lip service at the end from James McAvoy's character, but yeah, it's more concerned with neon colors and that 80s new wave soundtrack.
Yeah, that's the first thing that's in our face right from the credits, is the neon overexposed brightness and the based up 80s soundtrack. And I gotta tell you, it's working for me right out the gate. I'm sitting up in my seat and I'm paying attention now, because maybe it was the theater I was in, but the sound was incredible. I was ensconced with what was happening in this movie in the first parts here.
Yeah, you mentioned theaters. This was not an IMAX release. This wasn't a 3D release. I was in a plain old theater opening weekend. I found it funny because it said, based on the coldest city. I swear to God, I was in the coldest theater. I was in an icebox shivering through this entire thing. I thought it was trying for a Cold War effect, trying for a new type of thing. It's not 3D, but we're going to freeze you.
Sense of vision. You felt like you were in that ice bath with her.
Yes, I really did at times. But yeah, not a crowded theater. It was great, though, because I was able to rock out and enjoy this. I was so jazzed to see this film, and it gets you right in. I mean, you're in Berlin, there's some guy in a wife beater and an ugly robe running over fences and getting through chains, and this movie has a sense of humor. I don't know that starting with that title sequence, This Is Not That Story, is the type of sense of humor. That's almost like what I'd expect at the beginning of Dracula Dead and Loving It, but this guy, he thinks he's escaped, he's just standing there kind of catching his breath, and this car just boom! Right into him, and our audience laughed.
Yeah, no, that got a big gasp out of the audience. That, yeah, he just kind of fly, obviously on a wire, pulling him, the way he twists and turns, but it's very effective.
Yeah, I would say the sense of humor in this movie is few and far between, but the moments are all kind of, oh man, I shot Marvin in the face type of sense of humor. You know, the first time you see it, you're not sure if it's supposed to be funny or if you're supposed to take it seriously. But I think once it goes on a little bit, you start to kind of get the grasp of what things are supposed to give you a chuckle.
Yeah, and we're not sure what this murder is all about, because we cut to Charlize Theron's character, Lorraine, in an ice bath. And did she use ice from that bath to make that vodka? That seems very unsanitary.
Yeah, generally dipping a cup into a bathtub filled with anything isn't a great idea.
You got a point. But there's something there that I don't know if you guys got. When Jimmy dies, he says to his murderer, Yuri, there, how did you find me? It was Satchel, wasn't it? Did you guys catch on about Satchel? I don't think this movie does a great job of setting up Satchel here in the beginning, because to me, it's all about the list. This guy we see killed Jimmy had the list. Yuri steals the list. It's the list, the list, the list. Because we're brought in with this murder, I think people are killing each other for the list. Satchel was definitely something I was writing down when I reviewed my notes, but it was not in the forefront of my mind.
No, and having read the book, I wasn't even thinking that. In the book, they bring that up very late, that there's a double agent, even later than this film does. I feel this film really is trying to sell it a lot earlier that, hey, don't trust everyone here. But one of the things they don't really sell here is that it's a big deal for a spy to be killed. In the book, they really sell that, like, they they're always trying to sabotage each other, but you never just outright kill another spy unless there's a very good reason.
It's not spy versus spy with the bombs and the airplanes?
No, apparently not in East and West Berlin. It is much more subdued.
I think that's the perfect way to say it. I think that's going to be ultimately one of my problems throughout this film is a lot of it is subdued. I wasn't sure who Satchel was or if that was a big deal. Like you said, Jacob, you know, the fact that another spy killed another spy, that's out of bounds. That wasn't built up.
We expect that. We grew up on James Bond films.
Exactly. And the fact that she's sitting down to be interviewed by her superiors didn't feel all that weighty when it was happening. I felt like there was a tone that wasn't being struck in the proper ways.
It's not the tone of the trailer. I'll put it that way. For our donors, you heard what I thought about War for the Planet of the Apes, my problem with that title and what we were presented. And yeah, be warned here. If you go in thinking this is going to be a kick-ass film from start to finish, no, we're going to have a meeting with Lorraine and MI6 and CIA, and then we're going to flashback to her having another meeting with MI6, still talking.
Admittedly, my feeling on this is threefold. First of all, if I am ever a traitorous spy, I hope they give me a better code name than Briefcase. There's just something non-threatening about Satchel. The second thing is, yes, there is a couple of meetings, but it's edited pretty quick. It is funny that she flashes back from one meeting where she's meeting with MI6 exec Eric Gray and CIA agent Emmett Kurtzfeld.
Armin Zola.
Yeah, Armin Zola and John Goodman, Dan from Roseanne.
I can't wait to talk about Cloverfield Lane whenever we get to that for our donation series, because John Goodman, like, he really changed my eyes with that film. And so, like, now I'm kind of excited to see him. Like, he's always kind of, you know, the fat, funny guy. I'm just thinking of Roseanne, but taking on a very different presence now.
He's done great work in a lot of the Coen brother films. True. That's where I kind of changed my mind on him. But yeah, he carries some weight in this movie, and I was glad to see him on screen. I think he brings a little bit of that gravitas to a movie that so far has been a little bit all over the place as far as the scope of what we're supposed to be paying attention to. I feel like he kind of gives us a center point to pay attention to.
He does carry with him some threat because he's CIA. By the same token, there is a bit of humor when she calls him a cocksucker. They're like, what did she say?
Why are the Americans there? That is the big mystery in this. And again, this is different than the graphic novel. There's no ties to Americans. Americans never come up. There's no American spies in that. So why is the CIA here? And she keeps looking at that one-way glass where I guess what the head chief of MI6 is there watching her, and you think that's who she's addressing the whole time.
Yeah, that's C, and it's just a little bit of an odd dynamic because we see C, letter C, like, you know, M from James Bond. I get, like, this is really trying to be a female James Bond. You know, they talked in the 90s about making a Jane Bond film. I feel like they've done that here, down to MI6 and everything. So her boss, it's not M, it's C. He's watching behind one-way glass in the current interview, but then we flash back 10 days earlier where C and Arnim Zola, Gray, and Lorraine are all in the room together, and she's getting her mission. And here, again, when I'm watching this, I got that her mission was go to Berlin, find the list, find out who killed James, and meet your contact Percival. And later, we're going to show another snippet flashed back to this where it's also capture or kill Satchel. I think they really needed to hammer home the Satchel thing right here at the beginning because it's the main plot of the movie, actually. And I did go and see this movie a second time before recording because once I finally knew, hey, I got to focus on this Satchel thing, I saw the movie a totally different way.
And this is where questions really start coming in for me. Is there something more to the list other than just exposing the identities of these people? Because I kept getting the feeling that C had something nefarious about that list that would, like, expose him further than just his identity. You feel what I'm saying there?
I think what the movie says, and I will go with what it says, is that, you know, it'll just reveal all the agents that are working, that are spies over in East Berlin, and as the wall's getting ready to fall down, it's just going to continue to cause mistrust when perhaps that's an opportunity to make new ties with the Russians, and that's the danger.
There's that, but there's also Satchel. And that's what, I'm just hammering on this because that is the plot, is this list reveals the identity of Satchel. Anyone who looks at this list knows who Satchel is. And from my plot summary, Satchel is Lorraine. Lorraine is being sent in by C to find Satchel, who is the biggest leak of information from the MI6 office in its history. For years, Satchel has been letting out secrets. Satchel got James killed at the beginning. I find it funny that the guy who's killed at the beginning is named James. Again, I think they're trying to say we're the new Bond, and it's not too hard to beat Spectre. So C is given a very nefarious thing by being behind that glass, and you see his reflection, and you wonder if C is duplicitous. Are they setting him up? He's a red herring, but he wants Satchel. And so what you have to realize, I'm going to just look at this retroactively. We're going to see a flashback of James and Lorraine sleeping together, and then James tells Lorraine, Satchel's been exposed. I know who Satchel is. And so Lorraine gives the KGB the information to kill James to keep her identity a secret.
Aha. This does change the way I see this movie, because my interpretation after seeing it once and walking out was that she just assumed being Satchel after killing James McAvoy's character.
Oh, no. I think definitely she is Satchel from the beginning. I don't think she assumes an identity. It was always her.
Yeah, she was always working with the Russians on this, which is how she was able to give over James at the beginning. And then it's just, I don't know if it's luck or if she had planned that she would be the one sent in after him. But that list exposes her as the triple agent she is.
Yeah, one of the things that they state in the book, the reason why she's chosen, and they don't do anything with it here, maybe it would tip people off too early, but she doesn't speak any German, but she knows Russian. She could speak it fluently, and that's why they pick her for this case in the graphic novel. Here, yeah, it does seem like luck of the draw.
They do say her Russian is excellent, she's good at escape and evasion, proficient in intelligence collection and hand-to-hand combat. You're right, they never say she could speak German well, and later on she's going to be told her German's terrible.
Yeah, and she never speaks Russian in this. At least I don't remember any significant parts. She may have said a word here or there.
Yeah, there's quite a bit of subtitling, but I don't have the ear where I could very clearly discern if I'm hearing German or hearing Russian. There's KGB agents, there's Stasi agents going all around here. There's quite a bit going on. But my third point to you saying that there's a lot of meetings, Jacob, is this is from one of the directors of John Wick, and I got that kind of feel in these meetings. Like when John Wick was having his meetings with the guy who owned that sanctuary restaurant.
Those conversations were just so much more entertaining, though. There was humor there. Yeah, there's the funny cocksucker line, but you don't get a whole lot of that humor. To me, I'm shocked at this point because now I'm like, oh, great, I'm watching Clear and Present Danger or Hunt for Red October, where you're going to get really mired in all these politics that they're hard to understand unless you're a student of them.
I'll agree. And you know what else shocked the living hell out of me? The first fight in this movie isn't hers. When we finally cut to Berlin before she gets there, we're introduced to Percival, which I did refresh myself on the King Arthur Knights of the Round Table bit to see if I could find some kind of allegory to Percival. I couldn't figure it out. Other than he finds the Holy Grail and loses it in certain things. Maybe the list is the Holy Grail.
Yeah, they do radically change this character from the graphic novel. The graphic novel, he's a misogynist who has just stayed in East Berlin because he doesn't want to work with women, and you had Thatcher in power at the time, and it's an old man. It's not a young, hip James McAvoy.
McAvoy, I don't know if this was his choice or somebody in the costume department, but this is directly homage to Tyler Durden.
Yes, I thought so too.
I mean, his outfit is...
Well, is he filming an X-Men film? I did read an article that he's sick of these X-Men films because he has to shave his head. And he's always got like a shaved head when he wants to appear in other films. And he's got a shaved head here.
They could always put a wig on him. But yeah, I do think that it had to be growing back. Was he bald in Split? I thought he was.
Oh, he was. Yeah, yeah, that's right.
So he just never has time to grow it out, I guess. Slow grower.
But I do love this. Like, he's gone native and he's buying information with Jack Daniels and Jordache jeans, which, you know, this is very true. Even when I was in New Zealand in the 90s, people are like, oh, if you could get me Levi's or Nikes, like, they'd go for a lot of money. People love that American stuff.
I've seen this kind of thing depicted at the time. I remember movies. Everything was about the Cold War back then. And yeah, Levi jeans, Jordache jeans, whatever you had. Anything American was desperately wanted by the countries where they couldn't get it. And I found it interesting, the music choice here. It's the one time they kind of veer away from New Wave. They're playing Fight the Power by Public Enemy. I'm like, is that telling us something about Percival? I think more it's telling us something about the fact that he's in East Berlin, a city that is uprising against the military and against the KGB. They'll be a week later tearing down that wall.
Yeah, this might not be the story of the Berlin Wall coming down, but that's definitely the backdrop. So you do have all these young people, punks, playing, yeah, their rebellious hip-hop or new wave music, whatever, getting ready to try to overthrow the East Berlin, the Soviet government.
And we're introduced here to a codename that I was able to follow better because we actually saw the person, Spyglass. We never find out his real name, but he's a Stasi agent who has memorized the list. And Spyglass is the one who gave it to James. And now that James is dead and lost it to Yuri, Percival's like, well, you're screwed. And Spyglass is like, I memorized it. If you get me, my wife, and my daughter across the border, I'll just write it all down for you. So this is something else to know for later on. Spyglass knows who Satchel is.
Yeah, and I've got theories about that because that was something my wife and I, again, as we were discussing this afterwards, we're like, oh, what? Why would Spyglass go along with this? But we'll talk about it when we get there. But yeah, Spyglass played by Eddie Marson. I don't know if you remember him, Arnie, when we did The World's End.
I knew the name and I looked him up, but I didn't recognize the face very well.
Yeah, he's one of the friends. He's Peter Page. I think he's the first to go out.
He has some funny scenes here later on where he has to dress like a Westerner that I thought was rather, it did make me laugh. He kind of dressed like my father, actually.
It was funny to me because the way he originally looked with the glasses and kind of peakish, and then when they disguised him, it was the difference between being a character in a movie and what he would show up on the red carpet for the premiere looking like, you know? It's like, oh, here's this his character, and here he is looking kind of suave and normal, but... Yeah, I did recognize this actor, too, from At World's End, and he's pretty funny there. He didn't get a lot of chance to do much here other than look scared throughout his scenes.
No, but here he gets scared and runs away, and the first action goes to McAvoy, who I've seen him in a lot of comic book movies, but not throwing punches and punching...
Yeah, he's usually paralyzed in those comic book movies.
Yeah. Well, and this actually took me back to a movie he did that... I'd have to revisit it. I don't know if I'd recommend it or not, but Wanted with Angelina Jolie.
Oh, yeah, the bending the bullet.
Yeah, that movie had some good things about it and some bad things about it. So I don't know where I fell.
Yeah, the giant weaver ran by God. Yeah, the tapestry. Ooh.
Yeah, that was a little stupid. But yet I love the scene with the keyboard where he hits that guy in the face. So I was thinking about him in that kind of mode, in that super spy kick-ass mode, and in a movie that's going to show Charlize Theron kicking a lot of ass, the first blood is drawn by him as he beats up two cops, steals their car, and goes all stormtrooper by wearing their uniform. I don't know why he stole a uniform to walk underground, literally underground.
Yeah, it almost felt like there's a scene cut there, you know, because he beats them up and he rolls off in their car and then creates a distraction by letting that car roll into the wall and catch fire, where there was a comedic beat there too, where he kind of closed his ears and waited for the explosion, which ended up being about 5 seconds too late. But yeah, there feels like something is missing between the fight and that happening.
Well, we also miss out whenever he picks up those chewed chicks to screw. That makes him late picking up Lorraine.
This movie is not shy about its partial nudity, is it? There's quite a few bared breasts.
That's what's so weird is this feels like it should be, again, I don't have a problem with it being an exploitation flick. The fact that we have spent so much time on like real world Cold War politics, I'm like, is this an exploitation flick or are you trying to get some history to me?
I don't think any of us here are prudes when it comes to nudity at all, but some of the nudity felt just out of place and like,
exactly,
just to kind of shock you back into watching the movie, I guess.
it reminds me what kind of film I'm in. To me, my question is this a, like Wonder Woman, a big feminist power statement? Because you have a woman here who kicks a lot of ass and is a really badass spy and standing on her own. And there's going to be a couple of lines about women getting in the way of progress and things. You know, Percival doesn't completely ditch his misogynistic background. By the same token, Charlize was more than fine with all of the bisexuality and nudity and everything. So it's like, there's always that weird gray area where is a stripper being exploited or can a stripper be a feminist who's empowering herself sexually? You know what I'm saying by that?
No, I agree. I just don't get the tone of this film. Like, yeah, we're going to, again, sit there and have briefings, and then we're going to go to a girl-on-girl sex scene, which, look, I got nothing against girl-on-girl sex scenes. I just don't know why it's in this movie with the tone that they set up.
I think things really kick into gear, though. There's a lot of data dumps at the beginning, and I think on first watching, it's easy to miss all of the satchel stuff, especially if you haven't read the book. But when she lands in Berlin, yes, Percival is late because he had a weird three-way after the party. We never see him with anyone ever again, so it's kind of pointless. But you get, first of all, one of my favorite songs of all time playing, Major Tom Coming Home.
Oh, yeah.
And she's greeted at the airport by some KGB agents who claim to have been sent by Percival. And there's our first real action scene. As she's in the back of the car, she realizes she's been abducted. High heel, she takes off it, the shoe and hits the guy in the throat. And damn, now this is definitely making me think of that John Wick 1 kind of action as they're struggling in the car.
If she is KGB, do these agents not know that?
Yeah, this is really making me think about what you guys said earlier, and especially Jacob's point, that what we're seeing is her storytelling to the guys in the room.
Maybe, or maybe it's objective and what really happened, we don't know.
You know, the more I've thought this through, the fact that we see her splicing the tape together and things, I think what when we hear her words to the interrogators, it's subjective. When we see the video, it's objective. As for them doing there, she's being interrogated and they say, Mr. Bremovich. This is another name that I don't feel gets sold enough. Bremovich is the KGB agent who is Satchel's contact. Bremovich wants to know what she's doing here. Is she keeping a good show for Percival? Because Percival's following along in a Porsche. Is she fighting them for that reason? Is she fighting them because she's not supposed to be there? Later on, Bremovich is going to try to kill her. Maybe they feel like because the list is out, her usefulness is done anyway, and it's time to cut that tie before she can name her contact.
Yeah, as far as we know, what she feels threatened by this guy next to her with a gun, so she pulls that high heel off and digs it right into his chest. So I like this scene. I thinking back, you know, does it make sense? Is it objective, subjective? I don't know, but yeah, it's a decent action scene. And those John Wick guys know how to crash a car.
Yes, like, they do.
They really know how to wreck a car.
I got to remember that maneuver. If you're ever trapped in the back seat, unbuckle the driver's seat belt, steer them into a column, and then grab your own belt and hold on for dear life. I love the fact that this guy walks around for the rest of the movie in like a neck brace too.
Yeah, and Percival pulls up right behind her. I love when he like pops the trunk open on that car. It's flipped upside down, and he's like, let me get your bags, and they just drop out, and he walks away.
I personally don't know how big Berlin is, but this tunnel and the opening of this tunnel looked very similar to the Civil War scene where Black Panther and Winter Soldier had that car chase and motorcycle chase end.
Oh, yeah, it could be. Those were they are both Berlin, both shot on location.
Very similar in setup anyway, but yeah, no, the action has kicked in here for the first time in the movie. We've gotten a few fights, we've gotten a few this, but you guys are right. The car wrecks are where this movie lives. But I'm going to go with the assumption that if she's speaking in the room, that is, you know, something that could be subjective. If we're seeing it, it is objective. Because otherwise, I'm going to be confused throughout this movie.
I agree with you. I think that in order to discuss this movie, we just have to take it at what it gave us. The fact that at the very end, we do have objective reveals and that we see certain things happen that there's no way for Lorraine to know. It's a very confusing storytelling structure that we have flash forwards mixed with flashbacks in the flashbacks. It gives it a good momentum. I think it helps gloss over some of the more sticky not quite as fleshed out story points. This is kind of my problem, though, with spy films, like you mentioned, Jacob. I talked about this when we did the James Bond retrospective. I have a hard time following all the connective tissue on why James Bond, exactly what little piece of information he got that sends him to the Bahamas, that sends him to Louisiana, that sends him to Paris. You know what I'm saying? And so here, I think the fact that we've got this music going, it gives it a little bit of a rock video vibe. We've got all the neon going on. It's really easy to sit back and let the movie wash over you and not pay as close attention, but then it just leads to a really confusing climax.
My problem is the first hour of this film, it doesn't wash over me. I get kind of bored. There are moments of excitement. You know, we're going to have another action scene with Charlize, but you got to set up so many characters. We're going to go to a bar and someone's going to hit on her in the bar. And then this French agent's going to come up to her and they're going to talk. And it's just a lot of setup. And I don't know how much payoff there is for any of that.
Oh, you're right. There is so much setup. I mean, one of the characters that, you know, we have spoke about but kind of glossed over is the KGB agent. And our first introduction to him is they have captured those party goers, or at least some of them, and they're all lined up like they're going to be executed. They're on their knees in a warehouse somewhere. And he comes out with a boombox and was it 99 Luftballons he starts blaring?
The full German version, yes.
Yeah, they have the German version. They have a cover version in this.
Very nice. But yeah, this, I mean, it's a good scene and it's fun and it establishes the character, but it's long and I'm not really sure where it's going.
Doesn't he tell them, like, you're going to help me find Spyglass or else you're going to end up like this breakdancer that he beats up with a skateboard? That never comes back. There's never any betrayal by the punks of East Berlin.
There's a couple things going on here. First, I think we're being introduced to Bremovich because he's going to come into play after the climax of the movie, or in the movie's second climax, if you will. It's a little bit like Return of the King, that third Lord of the Rings movie. There's a lot of endings here. But we're being introduced to him. Also, even though this isn't a movie about the breaking of the Berlin Wall, all of these East Berlin punks and their partying and their protesting is going to aid Lorraine later on. And so I think we're being, I don't know if we're introduced to any from that group in that scene. I didn't pick it up. I was too distracted by, that's actually a good breakdance move he does, the one hand thing.
He needed some cardboard and he could have finished the spin.
See, this was another I shot Marvin in the face moment, though, where the way he did it was so slow and stilted, but it had me chuckling. I mean, doing a breakdance move while your friends are about to be executed in front of a mob boss was just a little too much for me.
Yeah, when he said dance for me, the music is on. I expected him to, you know, dance. I didn't expect him to do breakdance moves and the spins. But then when he gets hit in the face with that skateboard, the blood, they do this trick twice. And it's a cool trick, but I don't know they needed to do it twice. The blood splashes on the camera lens. So it's like fills the screen. I thought that was kind of cool. But you're right, Jacob. I don't think this scene really goes anywhere in regards to Spyglass or Yuri. I mean, it's just introducing us to this Russian guy. And admittedly, I'm saying they should have done more with Satchel to sell that. By the same token, there's so many Russians. It's similar to Dunkirk, that other war movie you referenced, Jacob. They're not big on saying names a lot. So it's a little bit hard to get the connective tissue.
At least they're not all brunette Englishmen.
Yeah. And another scene I don't know really adds anything is when Lorraine goes to the morgue to pick up the body and then goes back and because she doesn't have the right passport information.
Yeah, I feel like they don't really play that up in the movie. I mean, the point is that's what makes her have to stay in Berlin even longer is to get that fixed up so she's able to do more sleuthing. And did she mess up that passport number or did Percival actually mess up the passport number here? Again, it's a scene that could have been cut and you would never have questioned it.
Yeah, Percival mentions you're going to pick up the body. They're going to send you right back. This does explain why she isn't sent right back. But man, it's one of those weird details that, yes, it does add logic, but we need to get to more stuff. And I guess now that you're pointing it out, there is a lot of slowness as Lorraine begins her investigation here in going to the watch shop and going to all these various places, confronting Percival a couple of times, once in her apartment, once in his, where she finds his hustler.
And she gives him his coat. That's going to come back.
Yeah, he's very fast seamstress, I guess. He can really sew a microphone into a coat like nothing. But there is a really good action sequence here. It's after she goes to the morgue. She goes to James's apartment. And again, watching this the second time, I really got, she's there looking for any information because James knew she is Satchel. She's there looking for that. I mean, even Goodman's going to say to her, everybody's been in that apartment looking for the list. You had to know it's not there. She was there to get any information about herself, and just a bunch of cops come after her. Percival called the cops on her.
Yeah, and this is, again, I thought we were going to get more of this kind of stuff. And I think we do later on, but yeah, for whatever reason, she turns on the stereo so we could have a cool song playing while she kicks some ass. But yeah, this is a fun scene, like beating up these cops and jumping out the window.
I'll never hear Father Figure the same way again.
Yeah, that was a good song choice. If nothing else, I'm enjoying the soundtrack here immensely. But this felt like the film's homage to the Jason Bourne series.
Oh, definitely. I don't know why she goes all ninja. Again, there's things that look really cool in this movie. I don't understand why they happen, but like when she pulls that turtleneck up over her face and she's like a ninja beating up those cops, it's cool looking at least.
I felt like that might be one of the few stunts she didn't do herself, and that's why she pulled the mask up.
Well, but they keep that camera, and I know they could do edits, but like that camera stays on her that whole scene. It's kind of a static shot when she beats those two cops up and then pulls that down, and it's still her. Again, editing and computers, the way it is today, they could fake all that. They definitely fake a really long take later on in this film. So, but I thought, oh, maybe that was her. But I do agree. Like when I first saw it, I'm like, are they hiding the stunt woman doing this fight?
What I found impressive is she did so much training of her own stunts, and right next to her was Keanu Reeves training for John Wick 2, and they'd start sparring. So they were like John Wick versus Atomic Blonde. Actually, they had off-camera fights as they trained for their stunts that they... I don't think she did quite as many as Keanu did, but she did a lot of this herself.
You know, Jacob, you brought up her pulling up her turtleneck, and that was the very image from the movie that set me searching for images from the graphic novel, wondering if that came from there. Nope, it was just something they decided to do for no good reason.
The only action scene you get in that graphic novel is a staircase. We will get a staircase fight, but in the graphic novel, it is with one person, and it lasts about a page. It is not an action story.
I don't know that I'd enjoy that. Here, I like it when she does use that extension cord, and this was basically trailer one, is what we see in here. Her with the extension cord. You said Jason Bourne, and you're definitely right. I also thought John Wick. I also thought Jackie Chan, you know, the way he would use whatever non-lethal objects are around. Much like John Wick, they find a reason for her not to just shoot her way out of everything. She runs out of guns, or she doesn't have a gun with her. She's not allowed to take a gun, so she's using this extension cord, puts it around so many guys' necks, leaves it around a guy's neck, and uses that to, like, rappel down the building. That's confidence in that guy's ability to not go over the balcony.
And the length of cord you have. I mean, it could have been 3 feet longer and she would have splat, you know, but...
She does land pretty hard, but she goes through 10 cops in that scene, and you got the music, you got the action. I'm having quite a bit of fun, but it does slow down again as she goes to a coffee bar that she was given the card for from, is it the Russians who gave her that card?
Yeah, I thought so.
Then we're introduced to a character. All right, I understand there's some salaciousness and adolescent giddies to having Sophia Boutella here to play a female lover for Lorraine, but does this character, this French spy, I get that, yes, she does have a couple of things in the plot, but is there anything she does that couldn't have been done without her in this movie?
Well, yeah, because I guess ultimately her contribution is she took pictures of Yuri Bakhtin and Percival together, which we're going to see Percival kill Bakhtin. So I just assumed she was taking pictures and from that meeting, but were they meeting earlier?
Yeah, the reason she's in this movie is to have somebody from the side help provide any evidence for Satchel's story. And this is the one piece of hard evidence we have in a pre-digital camera world, in a pre-digital tape recorder world.
Yeah, my assumption is this was the meeting where Percival's going to kill him, and Lorraine is just selecting the frames that are going to help her story, where it looks like they're actually meeting and dealing for that watch with the list.
Yeah, and Sophia Boutella, she is everywhere since we first reviewed her in Kingsman.
Yeah, she had those gazelle legs, right?
Yeah, and they picked her because she was a dancer, not an actress, because she could move like the legs, and I figured we'd never see her again. No, she was in Star Trek Beyond last year as one of those creatures under the makeup. She's the mummy in the new mummy, and here she is again. There's no escaping her now.
Wow, those eyebrows are getting work.
She is definitely exotic, and she's introduced in a very tempting way when that guy's hitting on Lorraine at the bar, and Dalphine says three isn't always a crowd, but tonight it is.
Yeah, they just, again, they take so long to get together. It's like, just fuck already. If that's what you want to do in this movie, you've seen the trailer. Like, no, she's going to play coy and come to the club, and then some stuff's going to happen. Then Lorraine's finally going to go to the club. I just wish this movie was moving a bit quicker like its action scenes were.
That's one complaint I have at this point, too, is it feels like there's slogs of time that can easily be trimmed if not cut completely.
Yeah, I'd have to agree with that. And I'm, again, going back to the James Bond analog here, is that James Bond always has to bed the babe. So here, Lorraine is going to bed the babe. The difference is, usually, the babe being bedded is going to give really important information, or is the woman of the bad guy and going to betray the bad guy at the end. So I honestly suspected Dalphine. She's so innocent. Oh, I've only been a spy for 1 year. I wanted to be
she wants to be a poet. Come on.
Yeah. So I thought for sure, here's Satchel.
I did read something from the director, and again, this felt all very pretentious to me, but he's like, oh, I wanted to show how difficult it would be to have a relationship if you were a spy and couldn't trust anyone, and the different people you would want to confide in. No, you wanted a hot girl-on-girl scene.
Actually, change was made before he was brought onto the project.
Okay.
He didn't object, but that was something that the writer did with Charlize before.
Well, whoever did it, thank you. I mean, it was a good scene.
Here's the thing I told my wife afterwards. I'm like, you know, I like me some girl-on-girl action, but come on, it wasn't necessary in this film. Like,
now playing has ruined you, Jacob.
Well, if this was a full-on exploitation flick and it was just about gratuitous violence and sex and titty shots, it would have fit right in. What has thrown me is that they're trying to be something more serious, more like a Bourne film here at the beginning. And that, it's such a weird tonal shift.
It is. Charlize was very proud of this. First of all, she said if she did have a girlfriend, she wanted it to be Sophia. And second of all, she's like, don't compare us to James Bond. We don't go under the sheets for this. We stay on top like real people and show off a little bit.
The gauntlet's been thrown down, Daniel Craig. I want to see frontal nudity in the next Bond film.
I just wish that this mattered more. They even ask in the movie, you know, there's that funny line where Toby Jones, whose head, every time I see him, looks like it's been inflated with more helium. His cranium just keeps getting bigger. He's like, you made contact with the French agent then? But they're asking her, why did you pump her for information and did you get anything? Lorraine says no, but you see a moment of Dalphine whispering in Lorraine's ear about Percival. I think what she's whispering, I mean, two viewings, I'm not 100% sure. I think what she's whispering is that Percival is meeting with the KGB and working with the KGB, and so you can't trust him, which helps plant in Lorraine's head, I can frame him for being Satchel.
Yeah, we'll see in the second half as we get into it that one point Percival's going to reveal that, yeah, he didn't want to kill Lorraine himself. He wanted to get the KGB to do it. I guess so the blood wasn't on his hands, or he didn't fall under suspicion, or had to go through, they don't have Congress in the UK, but go through hearings of some type. But yeah, he wants to have the Russians kill her and not have to do it himself.
So why doesn't he? I mean, I guess that's where I kind of lose the thread, is why does he end up at her apartment to choke her and kill her?
Dalphine?
Yes.
The best I could do is Dalphine has those photos. And he's been framing Dalphine. You know, he has this line. It was very much in frame that on Percival's bookcase was Machiavelli. I'm like writing down, oh my God, Machiavelli. But then they bring it up and I'm like,
and then they said, I did the same thing.
Yeah, they're going to make it obvious in case you missed it.
I'm like, ooh, I'm going to bring up that they had Machiavelli right there. Oh, Yeah. Thanks, movie.
Every time we think we got him. And they're like, but he said, it's great to deceive the deceiver. So what you have here, he has bugged Lorraine's coat, but he used a French bug to do it. So she's trying to frame Percival for being Satchel, but he's trying to blame Dolphine for setting up Lorraine with the KGB so that he can get out scot-free. So by using a French wire so that MI6 would see the French wire in the coat, and then by killing her, she can't even deny it herself.
And so the reason he ends up there at that time is because he realizes that Charlize has started to unravel his plot as well, and that's where he needs to go to finish off that loose thread, I guess.
Well, yeah, I mean, because before we get there, we got to get back to Spyglass, because now Percival and Lorraine, they're going to try to get Spyglass to West Berlin since they don't have the list.
But Percival does get the list. It's like he makes the plans with Spyglass, but then because he's been bugging Lorraine, and I don't mean that as an annoying, but actually wiretapping Lorraine, he also wiretapped that watch shop. Yuri comes in to sell the watch. And so Percival kills Yuri and takes the watch. So now he has the list. So now there's two lists, one in Spyglass's head and one in Percival's possession. So now he no longer wants Spyglass to make it across.
Yeah, we've seen him call MI6 and say he knows who Satchel is, and we're assuming he's going to say Lorraine's name.
You have to be, right? I mean, that's got to be what you're thinking, but he does know at that point it's Lorraine.
Right.
He knows right then, once he gets the microfiche from Yuri, that Lorraine is Satchel. And he says later on he was going to take that watch to the Queen. He was going to take it back to MI6. So why he doesn't just call and say, oh, by the way, you put Satchel in my backyard. She's trying to kill me. But maybe he's lying there. Maybe he was going to try to sell it.
I take it that he was going to try to sell it. He's gone native. He is Marlon Brando in Apocalypse Now, more or less.
Well, he's still trying to play both sides of the coin. You're right. He is going to sell it or try to sell it. But at this point, as a first-time movie viewer, we're supposed to be thinking that he's Satchel at this point.
Yeah, my wife turned to me. She's like, oh, he's Satchel. I'm like, okay. You can think whatever you want. I read the book, I know. But yeah, she was thinking it's Percival. And I got to talk through, okay, this watch shop. Till Schweiger, we talked about him in Inglourious Basterds.
I knew he looked familiar.
Hugo Stigler. But he is actually CIA, I think, because he's going to give coordinates on a watch to Lorraine. She's going to meet another Berliner, that younger guy it looks like, but they're all going to be waiting for her at the end to take her to the airport to meet John Goodman. So I guess these are the Americans or American agents. They might be German, but they're working for the Americans. That's my take, at least.
Or at least allied spy resources.
Yeah. They know she works for the CIA. That's my guess.
Yeah, I think you're right in retrospect. I just took it as this was her contact and she was making other contacts. But you're right. This must be all of her secret CIA contacts, which is why she trusts them implicitly and why they're so willing to help her.
Yeah, they're going to get all the fake passports when they try to bring Spyglass across the border. She wants to go to her people. She doesn't want to use Percival's contacts.
Right, and because she doesn't trust him, and so yes, she does get, and this is where I wondered if that skateboard beat scene came into play, because she's going to meet up with basically the youth resistance on the East Berlin side, to which I absolutely love. One of them was playing that classic Tetris on the PC with the music and everything.
That got an audible chuckle out of my audience.
And when she's headed to East Berlin, again, I think Percival set her up with the KGB, the guy who, from that very first car wreck, who I just called the driver, who always had that neck brace on, is following her. She's dyed her hair brown or put a wig on. She's not atomic blonde for one scene and gets across.
Which is funny because in the comic, she's a brunette the whole time and puts on a blonde wig once. They reversed it here.
And they talk about Alexander Platz, part of East Berlin, where a lot of the demonstrations took place. And she's going to have a fight in a movie theater. That was kind of fun. Being in a German movie theater, I was thinking about our review of Demons.
And I don't know if you've seen the Tarkovsky film Stalker, but it's a weird sci-fi where there's like a it's called the zone that no one could go into, and people like sneak into there because like aliens had created this room that will grant any wish you want. So I guess they're doing some meta commentary there about people trying to sneak into forbidden areas.
Kind of. Actually, Leach talked about this and he said that he's not Tarkovsky's biggest fan.
Yeah, he's a hard one.
It was the production designer who said we need a film that could be on the theater in that time period, and that movie just was playing, and so the director picked it. But I looked into that film myself thinking maybe there's some big commentary here. There's Stalker posters all over the place that kind of look like Shepherd Fairey Hope posters, but they say Stalker. So it's got a real weird vibe to it. So I did look up that movie. I'll probably check it out, although it sounds like 3 hours of surrealism.
I don't think you'll like it.
Oh, I may not like it, but sometimes I have to do movie homework, and that sounds like something worth doing. But I did like the fight behind the screen, and the people beating her up were like, we just want to talk. She stabs one of them in the cheek with her keys.
Oh, yeah, that was...
That's pretty good effects, too, you know, because when he pulled it out, it was already puffing up on him. But every time we talk about one of these fight scenes, I'm sensing a little bit of a theme here is that they've picked almost another movie to pay tribute to. Like, this feels like a scene out of Kill Bill, you know, with the backlit screen and them being silhouette directly on top of it. It's not a ripoff. It does feel like, you know, a friendly homage or a bow to another movie.
I do feel like there's been so much done with action scenes, and yeah, I'll definitely call out another one later on, but I do feel like at this point so much has been done with action. It's just a matter of like referencing the best stuff now.
Lucas himself said, good artists borrow, great artists steal. And if you're going to have a movie that's going to have excessively long fights in it, Kill Bill Volume 1, you could pick worse movies to steal.
Definitely.
Me, I was just thinking about Gremlins, because that's the only movie I can think of where you went behind the movie screen.
Inglourious Basterds.
And Johnny Dangerously, yeah.
We have such very different reference points.
And we do get a weird scene. John Goodman shows up. I thought he was just around for the interrogation, but I guess he was in Berlin and MI6 called him up to talk to Lorraine. I don't know why MI6, that would be like me calling somebody from another podcast and be like, I can't get Justin in line. Can you talk to him?
Yeah, it's a weird scene because we don't know about the twist yet at this point in the movie. Why would you have CIA? I guess maybe he was just visiting Berlin and she happened to run into him.
This scene, though, on my second viewing, more than anything, it screams. It puts a neon billboard in this neon movie, Lorraine is Satchel. And I don't know if you guys got it. I didn't get it the very first time because I'm trying to keep up with everything else. But he gives her a card or a newspaper. It says, this call could change your life. She gets back to her apartment and she makes the call. And there's just this voice, Satchel has been compromised. This is the moment she knows Percival has told the Russians who she is.
Aha. Uh-huh.
And so since the CIA gave her that information, and it's the secret number, Satchel has been compromised, there's no reason for the scene if she isn't Satchel.
You're right. Jacob, you're right, too. I think there are some Kaiser Soze moments here upon a second watch.
So they go... Percival's got to take the wife and child of Spyglass. They're going one way. Lorraine's taking Spyglass. They're supposed to meet up over the border, but there are snipers. Are the Russians expecting her? I just assume because it's all spy versus spy, like the Russians know something's going down with Spyglass. It's hard to keep track of everything, though.
I think they just know where Lorraine is at all times because...
Yeah, she's got that platinum blonde hair.
Well, yeah. I mean, well, even when she went in disguise... over the border with that day passport or whatever, they knew right away that she was there and in the plaza. So I think they have her bugged or tracking her at every moment of the way.
Or Percival's giving the Russians her information because he wants them to kill her.
True.
But yeah, it's a great trick. They're all walking along in this march and the sniper could still get them, but they give the signal and all the youth resistors put up those umbrellas to block their view.
I loved that idea, and I was honestly shocked when Percival went so dirty as to just pull out a gun himself and shoot Spyglass. I was like, damn.
Because he wants to sell the list, probably. He doesn't want Spyglass to be able to make a new one. Why does Spyglass go with Lorraine? He has to know. If he has that list memorized, he has to know that she's the double agent.
Right, he does.
So why does he go with her then?
Okay, this is confusing.
Yeah, this is the point my wife got really stuck on, and I cannot give her an answer.
He meets with the Russians after he gets the list. Percival meets Bakhtin's men. They want the list from him. This is before they try to get Spyglass out. And he's like, what Percival says is, we've been in the trenches long enough to know that at times like this, Berlin has its own set of rules. I can give you information that can keep the balance. Are you in or out? So Percival's not going to give the Russians the film. They can kill him, but they won't get that film with all the list. But he offers them information. What he offers them is Satchel. And so all these KGB agents are waiting there to kill Satchel.
They should know who Satchel is, right? Or maybe she's so deep they don't.
They do know who Satchel is, and that Satchel could give away vital information. They need to burn that contact, as, you know, burn notice.
Right. Satchel is a useful tool to them, and once the information has passed hands, she or he is no longer needed.
Since Satchel's going to be caught by MI6, they have a chance to kill her before she can be tortured and give up her contacts.
For whatever the reason, I don't know if I still understand it really, but I do feel like this is where the movie picks up. Percival's going to shoot Spyglass. It's not a kill shot, but this is what leads to that great stairway fight that we all saw in the trailers.
And before we get to that fight, what happened to Spyglass's wife and kid? It's like, they come out of nowhere.
They make it over. We see them later.
They do? Okay. I missed that.
Yeah, they do make it over, and they're like crying. They've been told the news.
Yeah, they were in the background of a scene. Yeah.
Okay, that's right. But this staircase fight is incredible. I mean, the last half an hour of this movie is pretty much nonstop Charlize kicking ass.
Oh, yeah, no, is it only a half hour? Because I was trying to give it, like, it had a good half, but maybe it only had a good quarter where it really, really moved. But, yeah, this staircase fight where, again, there's no music here. Like, I mean, I'm waiting for whatever 80s pop tune to come up. Or, you know, I don't know why they did this. They used this song called Stigmata. It's a great Ministry song when they, like, really went industrial after they put out some bad Euro trash pop albums. They have a Marilyn Manson cover it, though, which really confused me. I love that album, that song, but I'm waiting, like, for, yeah, some great song to come on, but this feels, again, I like this stuff. It feels like a different movie. It feels like, here's our proof of concept for Atomic Blonde. This is how we'll get the studio to give us all the money we want by shooting this great fight scene that goes into a car chase. All in, there's some trick editing going on, but it's made to look all like one shot.
The staircase bit that just goes on and on, and the KGB guys keep coming and coming, and she's having to hit people over the head with sniper rifles because it's out of bullets. Meanwhile, in the background, Spyglass is trying to take care of his stomach wound with duct tape.
Yeah, I love, like, every once in a while you'll cut to him and he's like trying to stop the wound with something else. And yeah, she takes that sniper rifle, she's trying to load it, realizes there's no bullets, and just beats a guy up with it. Again, this feels very John Wick. There's a lot of headshots, a lot of two taps, one in the chest, one in the head going on.
This is where I'm kind of glad the movie wasn't in IMAX or 3D, because the motion here was giving me a little bit of a headache. I mean, I was getting a little bit motion sick, and it might have been because I was at a bigger theater and sitting a little too close, as we did have a full screening. But I was getting just a little bit motion sick from the pans and some of the blur shots going on here. So much to the point where I was almost hoping this staircase scene would end a little bit sooner than it did. Even though I was enjoying it, I almost wished that I was seeing it at home on a more manageable screen to actually catch what was going on. It was so filled with movement the whole time.
The thing I liked about this scene is how beat up Charlize got. It's not something you normally see.
This sets up the beginning of the film. Like, yeah, we see her beat the shit out of her, like, at the beginning of this film when she gets out of that tub, and this is where it all happens.
Yeah, it's surprising she survives. It's surprising anybody survives as many hits to the face and the body as she gets. She gets knocked down a half a flight of stairs. There are some hard hits. And like you said, Jacob, the only score is just the Foley work of the punches and the grunts and the exertion. It is brutal, but it's brutally fun. I mean, it's in a positive way, like a video game fight scene where the guys just keep coming and coming and she has to grab whatever she can. And it never feels repetitive, but I'll agree with Justin. By the end, I'm feeling as tired as Lorraine.
I guess this is the stuff I was waiting for this whole movie, so I was glad when we got here. And I was surprised. Like, they keep that shot going. They get into a car, Lorraine and Spyglass, and there's a chase. It's not laugh-out-loud funny, but I did chuckle with some of the ideas. Like, she's going forward and gets blocked and has to throw it in reverse and drive backwards. I don't know if you guys seen The Raid 2. Like, they do some crazy stuff with long takes and chase scenes where you watch the behind-the-scenes stuff where they're passing cameras on motorcycles through a car. I don't think they did anything that crazy here, but it's fun seeing these creative type of chases and fights that you could really do now with modern technology.
This chase scene, it felt very visceral to me. I mean, I actually felt like I was in that passenger seat the way it was shot.
It's weird because it reminds me of like a camera mounted on a person. I was thinking of the Snaz cam from the movie Pi, because when Lorraine is driving in reverse, my first thought is, we just saw a reverse car chase in Baby Driver. And because we're outside of the car in Baby Driver, that felt to me like there was greater stunt driving and car aerobatics. But because we were in the car in this fixed camera, it was just so weird because it was like I'm watching a movie screen, but then the windshield of that car is like a second movie screen. And so when that car is chasing her and then that truck comes out of nowhere, it's a really strange disassociative feeling. I liked it, though.
Yeah, I think it's as close as you're going to get to actually being in a car chase, you know, without actually getting hit by that truck.
and of course, because this is by the guys who did John Wick, when they finally do cut from this very long take, it is to show a car flip, and it is a glorious car crash. They do that amazingly.
And then she thinks she's escaped, and there's another car crash. They're sitting there and just having a moment breather, and you see out of the passenger side window this car coming to broadside them and knock them in the water. And he survived a gunshot, he duct taped, he survived the car chase, and Spyglass is going to drown.
Yeah, see, and this, you know, I know we made the decision back earlier that everything we see is going to be objective and not subjective, but there's things like this where I wonder if her objective retelling is glossing over some things. Like, did she really try to save him, or did she hop out and just let him go to the bottom of that river?
My wife swears that she killed him under there, that she made sure he died. But again, we don't really know. We'll see her messing with some audio tape later, but we don't know what's going on in these stories she's telling. I don't think they give us real evidence either way. I don't know. Arnie, you saw it twice, and you're saying you don't see it. Maybe people have seen it four or five times. We'll finally see those clues if they're there.
My thinking in this is maybe she was taking Spyglass to the CIA.
That's what I thought.
The CIA knew she was Satchel the whole time anyway. And she said that she never lost a package. This would be her first time. And more, she tries to help him way too much to then just let him drown. You know? So I think she really didn't want this saucy agent who's defecting. She really didn't want him to die, but it leads to muddy character motivation.
Definitely.
But great action, just muddy character motivation.
But this is where we get Percival. He goes after Delphine and goes and strangles her.
Yep, and Lorraine is figuring it out as far as, from our perspective, just two steps behind him.
Is it that fake cast that he's wearing? And then she finds out it's like Bug. It seems like Percival just leaves like all these clues when he ditches his place and she walks in. Like he's got the audio playing that he's recorded.
I think he thinks she's dead at this point. I mean, when you had that many KGB agents, when she was last seen in a car going underwater, I think he thinks she's dead. And now all he has to do is kill Delphine and everything is set up. No blame will be on him. He can sit there. The wall is coming down right now. He has to realize his days of selling Jordache is up.
There is a David Hasselhoff reference. There's an unseen celebrity, and they say it's Hasselhoff as the flash bulbs go off.
Yeah, two movies this summer with Hasselhoff references. This and Guardians. Hasselhoff's having a banner year.
Well, I guess he does appear in Guardians, doesn't he? In the credits.
Mm-hmm. He doesn't appear here, but he was on the Berlin Wall dancing in his Christmas yes. light jacket when the wall fell.
Yes, he was. So who is Percival playing the audio for then? Is that just for show? Is that because this is a movie? I mean, there had to be some reason why he would leave that on the stereo, blaring.
Yeah, I took it that he still knew Lorraine was alive and he was trying to lure her into some other trap, but Again, a lot of this film is very stylistic, and maybe it's just a stylistic choice. Like, whenever Lorraine's sitting in her hotel room, there's, like, neon along the top of the ceiling that gives a weird cracked reflection in the screen. So maybe it is just there for style. And, oh, look at this is like the evil lair in a James Bond movie.
Yeah, I was sad to see Delphine killed, but with the James Bond rule, the first woman he sleeps with always has to die, and Lorraine only slept with one person. Actually, I guess in flashback we saw her sleep with James. Both die. But Lorraine comes through, sees that Delphine has been taking all of those photos, and realizes she can completely frame Percival now that there's photos of him with the KGB, but she has to kill him first. And how she finds him,
Yeah, Delphine makes it easy for Lorraine. She puts him in an envelope and writes her name on her. Again, not a whole lot of sleuthing going on.
You're right, but like, how does Lorraine end up finding out where Percival is? I mean, she was there before he was coming out because she had slashed his tires.
Yeah, what's so weird is all of a sudden this is Lorraine telling the story, and all of a sudden I'm like, oh, what? Percival's like breaking the fourth wall and talking to us now? I guess he's actually talking to Lorraine, who has found him, but it is a weird moment because this is the Charlize Theron movie, and it's being told from her character's point of view, and now Percival is pretty much summing up, giving us the moral of the story. Oh, you know, it was secrets and all that, and trying to wrap all this up for us. But yeah, I don't know how she finds him because she's a really good spy.
Apparently. I mean, she wasn't a good enough spy to get over to Delphine's apartment in time, but I guess that's a matter of convenience to her survival.
She probably would have had to kill Delphine herself anyway because Delphine can tell when she's lying. There's that one moment where she's like, I can see in your eyes when you tell the truth.
I thought that secret whisper that we're never told about what was actually said, I thought that was a moment where Lorraine told her what was going on. That's why she turned up the music so Percival couldn't hear her. Even though he finds out anyway, so who knows?
See, I think that was Delphine telling Lorraine Percival's working with the Russians.
It's as mysterious as Scarlett Johansson's whisper in Lost in Translation, I guess.
But you're the one who's seen this multiple times, Arnie, so I'm going to trust your take on some of these questions, you know, more than my own.
Yeah, and yeah, I'm not sure either.
Right.
Well, and you know what? It's such a fuck up that MI6 decides we're not even going to report this to the Queen. This has never happened. I do think it's funny that Lorraine still wants that meeting with the Queen, even though they've decided to just wipe out this case. This never happened. We're going to shred the documents, I assume, get rid of the tape. But we did get these weird flash forwards of Lorraine listening to tape. And I'm like, why is she recording everything? A lot of shots. I'm like, I thought it was just to show her in lingerie of her, you know, wiring herself. But it's because she was taping all these conversations so she could splice it together for her bosses and make it look like Percival was the double agent.
Hey, Lorraine, now that Satchel's outed, I could use some extra audio editing help. And you're really good because you're able to take the sound of a guy talking in a dance club and in a warehouse and nobody questions it.
And she's doing actual tape.
Yeah, physical tape.
I guess she had to do like a second generation because you wouldn't want them to see that mending editing tape on there.
But yet when she's playing it, you see the editing tape go through the reel-to-reel. It's like, wait, what?
My first thought was, this is really cool that she's cutting splicing like this, but come on, it's 1988, 89. There are dual cassette decks out there. She could have done this much easier.
I was doing this kind of thing with VHS back then.
I do not doubt that.
It is strange, but this completely proves Lorraine is Satchel. We have no question. But if you need that even further, she's going to go hang out with the Russians, and they're going to have a... Was it Lethal Weapon 2 where they lay out the tarp and kill the person on it?
I was just thinking about horrible bosses when they hire someone for wet works and it's a very different kind when they put out that tarp.
Well, they have a scene like this in Snatched as well, where the back room becomes a plastic-coated thing where they're going to do those guys in and make no mess. So yeah, it's a very mobstery thing to do.
Never mind the brain matter that's going to hit the walls. Let's protect the carpet. And so they're still trying to burn her, and she's delivering the list, but it's a fake list. It's double cross, triple cross. Hey, we get another good fight, though. It's briefer because we're in the denouement of the story, but she is going to kick everybody's ass.
No, it's a good scene. I wish there was more of this stuff going on, especially during the first half of the film. But yeah, she took that watch with the list from Percival. She gives Bromovich a fake watch, I guess. And he knows it's fake, or he was just going to kill her anyway.
He was just going to kill her anyway. He thought that was real.
Yeah, the watch really doesn't matter. It's the microfilm inside of the watch. So the fake or not, it's, you know, the information probably wasn't in there.
But as Lorraine walks out of that hotel, or I guess waiting for her, dressed as bellboys, we see all those Berliners that have aided her, and they're there to get her out and get her onto an airplane.
Yes, because they were CIA, and this was the shock I did not see coming, is that she's an American.
Yeah, I didn't see this coming because, yeah, this is totally new for the movie. In the book, she was a Russian, and she goes back to Russia. It's very nihilistic, that book. This, at least the second half, feels more like a summer popcorn movie, and we're just going to do some twists and have some fun. I love it when she gets on that plane, and John Goodman's character's there, and he's like, cocksucker, wasn't that a little too harsh?
Definitely a nice bookend to the revelation that she's been CIA this whole time.
It leads me to some head scratching, like, does MI6 vet its soldiers so poorly that the US can take a American and fake that she's a Brit and fake that she's a dumb? Oh, it makes my head hurt.
Especially with that accent that Charlize is using when she's supposed to be British.
I think it's known that, you know, the CIA has poached people from other agencies to use as their own. So it's not outside the realm of possibility that she maybe started as an MI6 agent and was then recruited by the CIA years later.
She has an American accent, though, when she gets on that plane.
It was a fun bookend, and I guess I hadn't thought about her being MI6 before being CIA because of that American accent. I thought she was CIA, who then went and applied for a job at MI6, who then contacted the Russians. All I know is if there's a sequel, maybe it will be a little bit less convoluted than this because she'll just have to work for the CIA.
There is a graphic novel prequel, but it's just about Percival. Nothing about Lorraine.
Is it good?
I haven't read it. It just came out recently in the last couple months.
And you said the Percival isn't as cool as in this movie. So.
No, he's an old man. Unless they go back to the 60s or something. Yeah, he's a grumpy old man. No James McAvoy.
So Justin, Jacob, do you go Atomic for Atomic Blonde? Justin.
The first thing I said as I walked out of this movie was, I need to see this movie again. We talked about it here. This, you know, a lot of this stuff went past me, and I think a couple of us missed a few things. Having this conversation helped me put together a bigger picture of what this movie was trying to do. There's some slow parts, and there's some parts where I feel like it could have been trimmed. But, you know, early on, I was leaning towards it. This might have been another Suicide Squad where they had a really kick-ass rock and roll trailer and then just forgot to do a story. But the more we talked about it, I really don't think that's the case. I think there is a intriguing story here. And the stylization of this movie is in your face and it doesn't get old to me. The soundtrack keeps it going. And despite there being some sluggish areas, I will sit down and watch this again. And I think if you haven't seen it, you should give it at least one watch. It's funny that we saw this in the theater because this is usually one of those type of movies where I would have seen a trailer for it, forgot about it until it was on HBO and I caught it about halfway through and like, oh, that was pretty fun. Then I'll see it again in like 2 weeks from the beginning. That's usually my relationship with a movie like this. But having me sit here and judge it today, I'm going to go ahead and give it a green arrow because I think there's more to it than what I caught on in my initial viewing.
Jacob.
You know, it's all about expectations. I saw those trailers. I was super excited for this. My wife, she didn't really know anything. She just wanted to go to the movies with me. And she's like, oh, this sounds really bad. And she loved it. She was way more positive about it than I was as we discussed it afterwards and try to work our way through all the twists and turns of this plot. And so if you saw that trailer, I don't know. Just be warned. I'm just going to put it that way. You're right, Justin. I thought about Suicide Squad because there's so much style in this. And they do that spray paint thing. Like they did that when they'd introduce characters in Suicide Squad. And the music. I don't know. I just want to bang the gavel and say no more music videos as movies. I feel like over the last few years that has played out. And I want that done. And I want to get back to movie making and not long form music videos. I just, that is becoming more and more frustrating for me. I feel like this movie had a lot of style, a lot of glitz, a lot of neon, though. There's a Blondie song called Atomic. It didn't have that, and it's called Atomic Blonde. That's a little weird.
Yeah, I thought the same thing.
But I could have gone with all that style if this was just a fast-paced, kick-ass action film. And I just feel that first half when they're setting up the dominoes, that it's more of a spy movie. I just wasn't as engaged because there's so many characters. And I'll admit it, my bias, I don't like those kind of movies. I have a hard time getting into James Bond movies for that same reason. Just all the little clues you got to remember an hour later and how they get pieced together. Once the dominoes start falling, though, and the action happens, once Lorraine tries to get Spyglass out of East Berlin, I had a lot of fun with this movie, and it was enough fun that it outweighed some of the boredom I had towards the beginning. So this gets a mild recommend for me.
And I think this movie has a lot going for it in terms of visual style and the soundtrack. I didn't buy the soundtrack because I already own the soundtrack except for the few new covers and the couple bits of Tyler Bates' score here, but I really think it had a visual panache that makes me excited to see what this director can do with his next film, which we will be discussing next year, Deadpool 2, filming now. I also think Charlize Theron just embodies this role as the cold-hearted spy. Talking through with you guys, even on two viewings, you guys are pointing out things in the story that are frustrating that even I didn't catch. My big problem with this was that I didn't feel it sold Satchel. And you guys have pointed out, yeah, a lot of these storylines go places that don't end up being very fulfilling. But what this film really has going for it is a sense of place and time. I own all these songs, but keep in mind, we're supposed to be at a period piece of 89 with the backdrop of the Berlin Wall falling. They use this to great effect. There's this weird scene that I couldn't figure out the first time where John Goodman shows up in Berlin to talk to Lorraine, and he's like, "You got MI6 so messed up, they're calling in the CIA. It was like, what? What is John Goodman doing there? It's not till the very last plane scene that that makes sense. But they're looking over the Berlin Wall. They're talking about the change of history, how things are going to be very different. Take a picture. It's not going to be like this a few weeks from now. It's really got me into that time, that place. And I think that's why I didn't mind scenes that languished a little bit more and let me explore both East and West Berlin, be it the Stasi on the one side interrogating kids who had partied the night before, and then going to a coffee club and then a dance club on the west side to see what life was like over there. Maybe because I lived through the fall of the Berlin Wall, I'm a bit more interested in it than a younger generation might be, but I loved this film's sense of place. I loved its time. I loved being in this world of intrigue and spies and deception. So I give this a real solid recommend. I enjoyed the hell out of it. I wish it had done a little bit better at the box office. I don't know.
The Emoji Movie did better.
Oh, seriously?
Yeah, this came in at number 5. Emoji was number 2 after Dunkirk.
Oh, God damn it.
Come on, America.
Yeah. But, you know, movies like John Wick and The Mechanic and The Transporter, they don't have to open at number 1 to be profitable enough for another one. So I'm crossing my fingers, but no matter what, I want to see what David Leitch does next.
Well, yeah, because you're a big Deadpool fan.
But I also am now a David Leitch fan. I've seen 2 of 2 of his films, recommended 2 of 2 of his films.
Yeah, this has given me good reason to believe that Deadpool is in good hands. I've been, and I'm still a little intrepid about a sequel to what I felt was a great movie, but seeing the style, I think we're in for a fun treat come next year.
So that is it for this bonus review. Patrons, thank you so much for supporting our show through this new method this year. We're really excited to be doing these one-off reviews of films like this, some theatrical, some new to video, some movies that we wouldn't necessarily have been able to cover any other way. Like in October, we're going to go back and do one of the biggest hits of this year. It was an unexpected surprise, an early February horror film, Get Out.
Yeah, I'm super excited for this one.
And it's because of patrons like you that we're able to do it and going to do it. And another one-off, please do not mistake this. This is not a retrospective series. It's a one-off review, but right about the time Justice League comes out, we're going to review the other Justice League movie that hit big screens this year, Lego Batman.
Yeah, we're not going to do Ninja Go and the Lego movie and all those.
No.
The Maker series. You could get lost for months in the Lego.
There's a lot of direct-to-video stuff if you ever want to do a real long series. Longer than Stephen King, perhaps.
I'm going to watch that other direct-to-video Lego Batman movie. I'm going to rewatch the Lego movie. We'll talk about them. But we had a lot of people claim this Batman movie deserved to be in the Batman series. We don't think so, but we've heard your cries. We always try to do what our listeners want us to do. You want us to do Lego Batman, so we're going to do that as a one-off for you patrons. And patrons even get to pick what movies we review. If you go to that high level, you just have to do it for 1 month and then step it back down before it charges you again. But you can pick a movie for us to review. We have a couple coming out on the main feed pretty soon that were picked by patrons. Both birthday movies, Happy Birthday to Me and Bloody Birthday. And our very next patron review, also in September, around the same time as those birthday movies, we're gearing up for Halloween with horror. And one of our patrons picked The Legend of Hell House. So that'll be our next review as Stuart, Marjorie, and I go back into another haunted house film to see how it compares to its later films like The Conjuring, Insidious, and Poltergeist. And Amityville, of course. So if you have a movie you want us to do, you can head to the Patreon page and pledge for us to do it. And at the very least, it'll be here on the Patreon feed and maybe even on the main feed. So Jacob, Justin, thank you for joining me. And thanks for listening to Now Playing, where you just can't unfuck that which Ben fucked.
Nice.
I think I fucking love you.
That's too bad.
Thank you to all the listeners who have backed us through our Podbean crowdfunding campaign, and we hope you've enjoyed this special bonus movie review podcast.
Trust no one.
Now Playing relies on support from listeners like you to keep going.
It's an impressive set of skills.
So from all of us at Now Playing, thank you.
Talents can be overrated.
Now that you've heard this review, head to the Now Playing Podcast forums and share your thoughts on this movie. The link to our forums is at nowplayingpodcast.com.
You pay attention.
This podcast has not been prepared, approved, or licensed by any entity that created or produced the film Atomic Blonde or the graphic novel The Coldest City. Now Playing is an independent movie review podcast with no affiliation with any company involved in the publishing, creation, or distribution of that graphic novel, film, or soundtrack. All audio clips and music used are the intellectual property of their respective copyright holders.
Let's cut the crap, shall we?
The opinions expressed on Now Playing are those of the individual hosts and may not reflect the opinion of Venganza Media Incorporated.
You're right.
Now Playing is a Venganza Media production, copyright 2017, all rights reserved, and no part of this show may be reproduced, repurposed, or redistributed without the written permission of Venganza Media Incorporated.
Directed by David Leitch. But Gascoigne was ambushed and killed by KGB agent Yuri Bakhtin. But Yuri doesn't take, and yes, I spelled every name fucking phonetically, B-A-C-K-T-I-N. She exploits her contacts and makes new ones, including Spench Fry. I'll have some Spench Fries with that burger.
And Lorraine, it's Lorraine, right?
Yeah.
It's just a bland name.
It is.
Yeah, Delphine. Is it Delphine?
It's Delphine.
Delphine. Okay, there it is. Seville. She gives Bromovich. Hope I'm saying these names right. She gives Bromovich.
outside the realm of possibility that she maybe started as an M16 agent and was then, you know, recruited by the CIA years later while still pretending to work for M16.
Hey, can you say she started as an MI6 agent?
I said M16.
Yeah. You're right, Justin. I had a I'm like, it's not Stuart.
He's on the show.
I didn't buy the soundtrack because I already own the soundtrack except for the few new covers and the dropping stuff on the floor. And the what this director can do with his next film, which we will be discussing next year, Deadpool 2, filming now.
They just released a Domino picture.
Yeah, I don't know what I think of the fro.
I don't know about the pain over the eye.
Well, do you notice she's laying on a Deadpool bearskin rug?
I thought she was just laying on Deadpool.
Well, Deadpool, yeah. Deadpool rug.